Welcome to This Is Money. I'm Georgie Frost, and alongside me and editor Simon Lambert today is assistant editor Lee Boyce. And as the Woodford Empire finally comes toppling down, we ask what next for investors and what lessons will be learned. Also today, what is a comfortable retirement and can you afford one? Do you get rare coins in America too? And undercooking your car insurance mileage, but are you still covered? Don't forget you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, that's it. It's all over. The star has finally collapsed. Neil Woodford's been sacked, his funds wound up, including his flagship equity income fund, which at its height, remember in 2017, had a value of over £10 billion. Now fast forward to June this year, and it had reportedly sunk to just £3.7 billion. Investors fled and savers were stopped from getting at their cash. So finally, the decision was made to pull the plug. But the question is, what now for investors? What now for the star stock picker and for the industry as a whole? So Simon, briefly, remind us, what the heck went wrong?
So, Neil Woodford, who he, for any listeners who have been camping out under a rock, ignoring such sagas as Woodford and the word that we will not mention. He is Britain's most famous fund manager. Britain's most famous fallen fund manager.
I was going to say, yeah. It was for a good reason.
It was for a good reason. When Neil Woodford was at Invesco Perpetual, he showed exceptional stock picking skills. He delivered a return to investors that if you put £1,000 into his fund when he started, you'd have had £23,000 when he left. The stock market's performance obviously delivered some of that. Company's ability to pay dividends delivered some of that. But Neil Woodford delivered a lot of it by managing to tap in to the best of those two things. So the companies that managed to perform the best out of the stock market, because the stock market itself, in terms of the FTSE 100, didn't really go anywhere between 1999 and fairly recently. And also the companies that had the best ability to pay out dividends. And if you take those dividends and you compound them, you invest your dividends into more shares, they get you more dividends and so on and so on. It's one of the most powerful forces in investing. And he made a couple of good calls. He dodged the dot-com boom. He dodged the worst of the banks and the financial crisis. And he was seen as having a bit of the Midas touch. So he decided that he would part ways with his former employer. One of the issues was that his fund was absolutely ginormous at Invesco Perpetual. He was running a huge amount of money. And he would set up on his own boutique investment management firm. And he partnered up with a guy called Craig Newman. And the two of them set off on this great adventure. And to much fanfare, Woodford Investment Management was launched. The Woodford Equity Income Fund was launched. And there was a lot of hype around it, as there would be with anyone who had made investors so much money. And he did very, very well to begin with. The fund was launched in 2014. And by April-ish 2017, it was up 40%. And then if you look at the chart of the Woodford Equity Income Fund versus the average UK-focused fund, he invests in UK companies, something happens, there's a divergence, and the average UK fund continues to grow. The Woodford fund starts to take a nosedive, and it just keeps going down and down and down and down until there came a point where it went below the 100p price that it had been launched at. And it's continued to go down since. Now, Woodford had, unsurprisingly, a lot of investors start to pull their money out of his fund. This exacerbated a problem whereby he wasn't really doing what it said on the tin with his fund. Now, he's made no secret of this sort of hobby horse investment thesis of his, these university spin-out companies, biotech companies, exciting companies. But people didn't flock to put billions into his fund because they wanted to invest in what was sort of drifting towards being a risky venture capital fund. They put it in there because of his reputation for investing in big companies, big income, making the right calls. And so they started pulling their money out, which meant that he had to sell shares to meet the money that they were pulling out. And the most liquid shares in his portfolio were the big guns, which meant he kept drifting towards the smaller guns. But eventually the doors were shut in June to protect investors because so much money had been pulled out. It had gone from nearly 11 billion to just under 4 billion, 3.5, 4 billion. That's a huge amount of money to be pulled out. And in the meantime, his only hope was to reposition the fund behind closed doors and for him to start beating the market again. And what's happened is that he has woefully underperformed the market, even while the doors were shut. He's down 17%. The market's up just under 2%. And the doors had not reopened yet. They were due to reopen in December. Barring some form of minor miracle, there was no way that those doors could open in December. Because what's the first thing that's going to happen if you're been locked into a fund by a guy who you've lost all confidence in, who's continued to take millions of pounds in fees and refused to cut them? What are you going to do when that door opens? You're going to rush for the exit, aren't you? So they've decided to wind it up.
Was this inevitable? Were there other more structural issues here, or was it a question of hubris?
From what I just said, it probably sounds inevitable, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
But that's all said with the benefit of hindsight. So I remember the day earlier this summer, because I have a memory that can stretch back 4 months, just about. It can do the start of June.
Well,
ask me about February, I got problems, but it can do the start of June. I remember the day when it was suddenly announced that they were shuttering the fund. It was the afternoon, and a certain Mr. Lee Boyce sat in the studio with me, exclaimed a word that I'm not going to exclaim on the podcast. Neil Woodford's fund's been shut. And that was a real shock. But actually, when you thought about it, it was inevitable that that was going to happen because of what was going on, the disastrous pulling out of money. And what's happened since it was shut, again, you think, well, this was ultimately inevitable, because how on earth were they going to ever reopen the doors to this fund? They would have had to wait for ages. Now, the irony is, Woodford might be proved right. It might be that these value companies that he's bought do turn out to be quite good, because he's made these risky bets on these more risky companies. But he's also had this, I don't think Brexit's as bad as everybody thinks it is. I'm buying these bombed out companies. They're going to bounce thing. There's a huge irony in the fact that in the week that he gets booted off the fund that bears his name and it's announced it's going to be wound up and sold back, the money given back to investors, that Boris declares he's got a great new deal. and there's the thought that we might possibly be leaving on the 31st and see this bounce. And actually, we've seen the share prices of some of these companies bounce over the past week. I guess most people thought that what was probably going to happen was that Woodford and his business were toast. He has taken £63 million out of that company over the last 4 or 5 years. His business partner, Craig Newman, has taken 37. Now, if ever there looked like there's a mistake of taking a load of money out of a company, it's this one, and then charging people £8.8 million in fees while they're locked into it. So it looked like his business was toast, and it also probably looked more, I think, to people in the industry, like the fund was just going to have to be, you know, bought by someone else. It might be another fund bought it and merged it into it, and then it could absorb that into their own fund and somehow work it through. This, you know, was, again, a shock when the news came through this week. Mm-hmm. But then when you look at it with the benefit of a couple of hindsight, you know, you think, well, yeah, it was inevitable.
My sympathy will obviously lie with those people with money there. Mm-hmm. So don't think just because I'm first asking Lee from your exclamation, which is probably quite rude, so we won't to this point now, I'm going to ask about what next for Neil Woodford. We will get onto what now for investors too. But do you think that's it? Is the time of the star fund managers over? Or has Simon actually got a point? Because whenever we hear Simon talking about investing, the long term, right?
Exactly. It's always about the long term, isn't it? And his track record beforehand was very good. People believed in him. When he launched that fund, they piled money into that fund, believing that he still had the Midas touch. And for a little while, it looked like all was rosy and everything was, you know, steady growth was happening. And then something like this happens. And there's so many lessons to learn from it, Georgie. And number one lesson is, of course, it's all about diversification. I've had too many people get in touch who sound like they've just kind of blindly followed him, put money in, and haven't diversified elsewhere, had other investments, other ways of saving. It shouldn't be 100% of your savings plan should be in one thing. So that's lesson number one. Lesson number two is, you know, past performance, of course, doesn't always reflect on what's going to happen in the future, which is a classic adage that gets bandied around all of the time. You can't, you know, Neil Woodford is human, I think. And if you can't every year, in my mind, deliver, you know, the kind of growth that he was delivering. And as soon as you get a wobble like that, people begin to panic, start to take money out. And it's a classic sort of, you know, that's a way to make a fund like that collapse. What's next for Neil Woodford? Will he, you know, launch anything in the future? I'd be very surprised. I mean, he's raked in, as Simon says, tens of millions of pounds of fees. He's got a nice, tidy £13 million house in Gloucestershire. He's got his £6 million house, holiday home in Devon. You know, he's got his 17 horses. You know, I'm pretty certain that it's all over for him. And the thing is, there's going to be, you know, I'm going to, again, guess he's going to be asked to explain himself in front of regulators and that type of thing. What comes of that, who knows? Mm. It's so difficult because investing always does carry risk. Of course it does. And all of these websites and all of these funds and all these places will carry warnings. So it is up to investors to know what they're investing in and know the risks and know that you can't always... your investments can rise and they can fall.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. But we've had so many people get in touch, Georgie. So many investors get in touch. We've had dozens upon dozens. And we couldn't... We published an article yesterday with some of their views and some of their thoughts. And there's also...
Scathing.
Scathing, yeah, of course. And actually a couple of people saying, well, you know, take the loss on the chin. I've diversified. I've got other investments. I've got set money in some savings accounts that, you know, all they pay an awful rate of interest, you know, is safe, yeah. You know, not for safe from inflation, but safe, you know. So yes, a lot of scathing comments, and actually a lot of criticism directed towards Hargreaves Lansdowne.
Explain why.
Well, because they had it on a list of, had it on their, is it the Wealth 150, which is
was trimmed down to the Wealth 50 from the Wealth 150. Originally the Wealth 150, trimmed down earlier this year to the Wealth 50.
So they plugged it fairly heavily, I would say, and even when there was like a little bit of trouble afoot, you know, when the fund price was starting to drop a bit, you know, they were saying stick with it, et cetera, et cetera. And it was quite heavily pushed. But look, also, Georgie, I think the media has to hold their hands up as well. You know, in the last few years, a number of publications, including, you know, ours, have been pretty, you know, glowing at Neil Woodford. I think we have to, we never say we're advising people. That's the crucial difference. We're not advising people to have invested in Neil Woodford. But of course, he had quite a lot of, you know, positive press across the board.
Yeah.
You know, so no one is, you know, innocent in that respect in terms of the media. Of course, we don't get paid to push it and we don't get, you know, commissions and all that type of thing. But
as you know, Simon says, investing is for the long term. As you say, investing is for the long term. Some of those investments could prove in the future to be right. I mean, it was a very big fall from 2017 to June. In terms of what happens next for Neil Woodford, and we'll get onto America in a minute, but they do love a failure, though, don't they? Because then it's the only way you learn. So maybe he's got a whole new career in the States. Who knows?
As a sort of motivational speaker about how the rise and the fall of the fund manager. Georgie, oh wow.
I've sorted it all out for you, Neil.
You mean like a much less interesting version of Jordan Belfort from The Wolf of Wall Street?
Yeah. Yes. But
unless there's been some stuff going on with, you know, dwarves and everything behind the scenes that we don't know about. Yeah.
I doubt it. Was there an issue, Simon? And I'm not... Bear with me when I use this analogy. I'm not likening it to Bitcoin. But the point about Bitcoin, or something that everybody's heard of, is those people without perhaps the knowledge of what Lee was talking about in terms of diversification or long-term investing have heard about this, thought, I'm going to get involved with this. Neil Woodford, I've read him in the newspapers. You know, maybe I should put some money in there. And of course, when something happens, they get frightened. Was there an issue that actually Neil Woodford probably should have kept it a little bit more boutique for a little bit longer, a little bit more, not taking so much money? 10 billion is a lot of money.
Well, I think that there is a very strong argument for that. And I think that what happened was there was two things that went on with this fund. One, Neil Woodford made no secret of his interest in these riskier companies and that he was investing in them. He also published a full list of all of the companies that his fund held. Most funds only publish their top 10. He published it every month and he published the percentages that he was holding in those companies. Mm-hmm. However, what he also knew was he's a smart guy. He's been around long enough to know that, as I said before, all these people were not chucking money into his fund because they wanted to back a risky small company biotech spin out orientated fund. It was because they were in what they thought they were investing in was a big, stable, steady income fund. Now, you could argue that those people didn't pay enough attention to what they were doing, that they didn't check up on where their money was. You could argue that their advisors didn't check up on it enough. You could argue that the platforms that were recommending him, Hargreaves Lansdowns of this world, didn't. To be fair to Hargreaves Lansdown, when they relaunched the Wealth 50, they did an event where they invited, you know, the investment senior investment journalists from all of the across the media publications, and they sat there in a room and they did their whole thing about this big launch. And then they spent about an hour getting grilled about why Woodford was still in it. They didn't refuse to answer the questions. It overran because of that. And then almost every single article that was written after that event was, why is Woodford still in this? So, yes, I think you can hold the press responsible for a bit of cheerleading and mentioning him and not questioning it. But also, if you look, we started to question what was going on in this fund. Many of our rivals started to question what was going on in this fund long before the shutters were pulled down. We were highlighting how much money he was paying himself, how much money was being pulled out. Woodford Investment Management, for about a year before, at least, the shutters were pulled down, was distinctly unhappy with the press that it was getting. Okay, it was being very, very prickly. So there were the warning flags. But, you know, people invest their money and they're told it's a long-term game and to invest their money and allow time to take its course. And so they don't, you know, check up on stuff every month, pull their money out. They're told not to chop and change. Mm-hmm. And it drifted. At launch, half the fund was FTSE 100 shares. By the time it was shuttered, that was down to less than 20%. I mean, that is sort of ridiculous. And the problem is that a lot of these people, it's really damaged the investment industry because the biggest, most stable, steady Eddie guy, they wanted steady Eddie, they got Swiss Tony, right? They thought that this was trustworthy and they've lost money off the back of it. It's not gambling. They've not lost all of their money. They'll get some of their money back. But I have money invested in the Woodford Fund and the Woodford Patient Capital Trust. I knew what I was getting in for. I trusted his judgment and that I thought he would actually manage to turn it around. And I was willing to wait on the value element of the fund. And do you know what? I was wrong there. I learned a lesson. I was wrong. The Patient Capital Trust, I think, was still a decent investment, but has just got infected from this. And actually, maybe it turns out that Neil Woodford, man who makes big calls on FTSE 100 and FTSE 250 shares, just ain't that great at picking these smaller, more risky companies. Maybe there's better people suited to that. So I made the wrong call, but I lost 900 quid.
Okay.
Now, I don't want to lose 900 quid. I expect to lose more, actually, by the time I get my money back from the fund. But I'm fine with that. That's okay. I can earn that back. It's not a problem. But for the people who've written into us who are down thousands or tens of thousands of pounds, this gives the risk that they will see investing as gambling. All the people who've read these stories go, who would have said, I wouldn't invest my money, it's gambling. It's not gambling. It's completely different to gambling. If you gamble your money, you make the wrong call, you lose your entire stake.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's very unlikely to happen if you're investing, especially if you invest sensibly and you diversify and so on. But that's the message that's come across to people. And actually, if you talk to people about this, people who've got money and have lost money are very angry. But some of the angriest people about this are the people who work in the investment industry, the trustworthy people who work in the investment industry,
imagine,
who are furious at what has happened, how it has undermined trust, mm-hmm. and how they're really angry at how Woodford and his business partner were allowed to get away with it and pulling all the money out and all these things. And actually, you know, setting up his own firm, Woodford should have just gone, no, I don't want it to get too big. You know what? I want to be smaller. I want to be more nimble. I'm happy with just making X amount of money,
yeah.
and I'm not going to let the fund go above, you know, 3 billion, which is still an awful lot of money, especially if you're investing into smaller companies, because in order to make a meaningful investment in a smaller company, you're buying a huge chunk of it. So actually, we heard too big to fail in the financial crisis. I think in the end, for the kind of investments Woodford was making, his fund ended up being too big to succeed.
I'm going to move on from this in a second, but I do want to find out about the lessons perhaps that can be learned from this, Lee. And Simon makes a great point in that those people that are most annoyed is the investment industry themselves, mm-hmm. because the number of times we've sat here and discussed is it worth getting someone and paying the little bit extra to get someone to pick your shares for you? Should you just either do it yourself or track a fund? Those sorts of things, you know, is it worth it? And you look at this and you think, probably not.
Well, the number one thing to definitely say about this, Georgie, is don't be afraid to invest because of, off the back of this. You know, there will be a lot of people that read that and go, oh, you know, I knew investing was risky. You know, you shouldn't get involved. Stock markets, share picking, all that sort of thing, confusing. Mm. Don't want to get involved. It's just, you know, it's too complicated. And I can understand all of those sentiments. But, you know, investing in the long term is a worthwhile exercise. There are a lot of people out there who can give you good advice. Look, Woodford, at the end of the day, had a track record of decades and decades and decades of doing well, you know, and made people who got involved right in the start many, many moons ago a lot of money, you know. And I would say that, you know, don't go into these things lightly, of course. Don't just blindly follow fund managers that you've heard of. You need to do your research. You need to look into what you're actually investing in and what you're looking at and what you're doing and what your goals are and what your long-term sort of, you know, what are you saving for? Retirement? Are you saving for a rainy day fund? What is it that you're looking to do? And I touched on it earlier. It's all about diversification. And if you put all your, this is the classic putting all your eggs in one basket. I'm not saying everyone's done that, and a lot of people, of course, wouldn't have done that, but some people have. They just, you know, had some cash, invested it all in that, thinking, well, it's going to keep ticking higher and higher and higher. You know, you can have too much of a good thing, Georgie, in my mind. So, you just have to diversify, you have to have a good blend, and there's plenty of information out there that you can research yourself about what that blend is and how you want to do that and what percentage should go in cash or savings and that type of thing. You know, a lot of these funds have risk warnings, have a sliding scale, you know, of this is pretty much safe and as safe and steady as stocks can be. Yeah. And then you go to the other end of the scale where it's high risk and it's companies that perhaps are going to deliver some really bumper returns, but they can also deliver some really, really quite bumper losses. So it's all those sort of things to consider. But I think the number one thing is just don't be put off from investing full stop because of all of this. You know, there's been a lot of press around this. It's been one of the biggest personal finance stories in the last decade, really, since the financial crisis, because of the amount of money that is tied up in it. And, you know, a lot of people in the investment industry, of course, are going to be annoyed by this because a lot of people are going to be frightened off.
What should investors, just quickly, what should investors do? How much are they going to lose? I mean, someone, you're losing £900. Have you got stories of people losing a heck of a lot more?
Oh, we've got stories of people who are down tens of thousands of pounds.
Goodness.
Yes. What's going to happen is they had to give 3 months' notice on this. So they're going to start unwinding this and trying to start paying people back their money from the middle of January. They have divided the shares into two pots, pot A, pot B.
Yeah.
One of them is the easier to sell large company shares, listed shares. The other one is the harder to sell companies. Perhaps they're not even listed on the stock market. They're going to try to sell off the larger company shares into the market. The smaller ones, they're going to have to find a buyer. They're going to have to try and unwind the whole thing. It's been handed over to BlackRock and another company that I can't remember the name of off the top of my head, so I'm not going to say anything. In order to do this, people will still continue paying fees for the time being, but then those fees will come down and eventually they will get their money paid back to them in gradually. Could cause issues for people in terms of capital gains, but it's highly unlikely many people would have made a capital gain on their investment in Woodford, so actually they'll probably be making a loss. The one thing I would say that we could learn from this is do your own research, always question what you're told, and pay attention on the way up, because that's the time to be paying attention, not only when stuff's on the way down. And maybe people should think about the size of some of the funds they're investing in. There's three other very popular funds. I'm not saying that they're bad in any way, but the Linsell Train UK Equity Fund, hugely popular, run by Nick Train, has done really, really, really well. A guy who regularly comes out and says, you know, you really need to be thinking about what you're doing to his own investors. So kudos to him for that. That's £6.9 billion in size. The Linsell Train Global Equity Fund is £8.6 billion in size. Fundsmith, one of the most popular funds, Terry Smith's fund, done super, super well, tends to invest in the world's biggest companies, so they're pretty liquid. You can sell their, buy and sell their shares pretty easily, but still, it's £18 billion in size. Now, maybe when people are making their investment decisions, they might want to think about that. Or you can buy into an investment trust instead, which is limited in size because its shares are listed on the stock market. If it wants to expand, it has to issue more shares and it has to get shareholder approval to do that. That means it's not a forced buyer or a forced seller. It doesn't have to shrink or rise in size. So it doesn't have to sell shares or buy shares as investors either sell out or pile in, but it can go to a discount or a premium to the share price. Woodford runs, well, Woodford ran an investment trust as well, and that is trading at a very, very big discount, its share price to its net asset value. So you could get out of it, but you'd have, in order to get out of it, you'd have to be selling, you know, a good 30% below what the assets are actually worth.
All right, well, we'll move on from that. One person that probably doesn't need to worry about their retirement, Neil Woodford, as Lee so beautifully pointed out. 13 million Gloucester home. That's outrageous. Is that right? Goodness.
In the Daily Mail story, you know, we like a property price. So it was, that's where it was listed as.
Dear, oh dear.
Closer to 14 million, I believe.
Yeah, well, I'm pretty confident he's going to have a comfortable retirement. But what does that actually mean for you? Holidays in the Med, dining out, quaffing fine wine? Well, if that is you, you may need to take a long, hard look at your pension pot at the moment and perhaps take a little bit of action, because the pension industry just produced an in-depth guide to how much our spending habits and favourite brands will cost us in retirement. Now, the idea is to try and encourage us to put some more aside, but how much more? Lee?
Well, this was a study from the Pensions and Lifetime Savings Association along with Loughborough University to kind of encourage people to save more.
Right,
because
yep.
A pension is one of those things that I think, especially when you're in your 20s and 30s, you find it, or early 30s, you find it quite an unsexy term. You're not thinking about when you're in your 60s, 70s, 80s. You know, who wants to think that far ahead? God, you know, it's kind of terrifying, isn't it? It's kind of a scary thought to think of you
especially
old.
When you have so many other things you need to pay for. Well, house or
exactly. So, you know, we all have these financial pressures, and what that usually means is that a lot of us put it off, and not until it's too late, but we put it off, make it more difficult for ourselves. We could have started a little bit earlier and maybe just saved an extra percent or just a small amount, you know, especially in your early to mid-20s when you're first starting out your careers. It's worth thinking about, and it's what I would really encourage people to do. And actually this research really highlights this point, is to use you know, a calculator online. You could type in what your private pension pot is at the moment. You can play around with monthly contributions, if you upped it by a percent, etc., etc. And then you can have a look at when you're going to be in your late 60s, 70s, what that will mean for your pension. And you'll be so surprised what an extra 1% or 2% might mean. A lot of the time, your employer will match it, or it's in some cases will double it. So it's essentially it is the best way for you to save. Yeah. The caveat of that, of course, is that you're not going to be seeing the benefits for a good few decades. But, you know, you've got to start. So this research, and again, what I would say with this is that when you use a calculator like this, it's quite difficult because you don't know what return you're going to get over the years. But I would suggest putting in something like 5%, you know, just as a ballpark figure. But usually you can go, well, they'll have a button and you can say, if you don't return that much, so more like 2 or 3%, or if you're really lucky and it's like 8%. But it'll give you a sort of rough ballpark figure. And what I'd recommend is looking at what your annual sort of salary will be from that. So when you retire, what you can take from it. And what this research says, that the minimum standard for a single person should be £10,200 a year. A moderate retirement income is £20,200. And a comfortable retirement income is £33,000. Now, if you're a part of a couple, it's £15,700 for minimum standard, £29,100 for moderate, and £47,500 for a comfortable. Now, we had a brilliant infographic about this on the Daily Mail story, which will visually highlight your standard of life if you manage to save a bit extra. And it is great, and I know Simon wants to give a rundown of it, so I'll let him do that.
Yeah.
but it is real food for thought, or £8 wine for thought, when you look at what kind of lifestyle you can get. And the other thing I would say is, we're talking about Woodford, and a lot of people go, oh, you know, I'm not investing in the stock market, you know, I'm not interested in all that. If you've got a pension, you know, you are invested in the stock market. And, you know, it's so simplistic, but you should have a look at what, when you are paying out monthly, you should be keeping a good eye on your pension. I think a lot of people just really can't be bothered. just lack of understanding. I do think that companies are a little bit responsible in this respect. I do think there should be a little bit more education around, you know, this is your pension, this is how much you should probably be saving into it, this is what we're going to put in for you, here's all of the tax relief you're going to get on it, and this is what it's invested in. And what we'd recommend is having a look through the funds that you could potentially go through with our provider. And you can, it has a breakdown of all the companies that it's invested in, and it's about diversifying again. Need to have, you can't, it's so many people just have one fund that they're investing their pension in. You know, you need to mix it up a bit.
I think what muddies the water as well, and will do in the future, is the fact that we have a growing army of people going self-employed and freelance.
Oh, definitely.
Option, and you don't have the auto-enrolment and the pension contributions from your employer.
Exactly, and then you know you start going down the road of something like a SIP, for example, and then again, people are just like, ooh. My friend of mine's been self-employed for about 5 years, and he's got a good accountant who kind of, you know, recommended a SIP product to him and that kind of thing. It's all about the education and knowledge, because you don't want to get left behind. And in all frankness, Georgie, I just don't think you want to be relying on a state pension. No. Not that it's going to be enough for that moderate income level. But it's all food for thought. And you, in my personal experience, I regret not upping my pension contributions a decade ago, 8 years ago, 6 years ago. I wish that I put more into my pension than what's in it now. And I'm playing a bit of catch up.
I imagine you are not alone in that. I guess, Simon, what's good about this is the... Do they call it an infographic? I don't know what they call it. But you can actually visualise what life would be. But you rather like that. You think they've done well, don't you, the people who produce this?
I'm going to take my hat off to the PLSA and Loughborough University here, because they absolutely nailed it in this report. It is absolutely superb. People really struggle to picture retirement and what they need and what lifestyle they'll want. And you can talk to people about, oh, well, you know, do you need an income that's 30% below what you have now, and how will you do things and everything like that. And they have gone through it in such brilliant detail and absolutely hit middle England on the head, nailed it, stuck them up. Dart between the eyes kind of thing. So, you know, for example, the comfortable lifestyle is superb. You can buy £8 bottles of wine. So you could get your Marlborough Bay Sauvignon Blanc. You can do 75% of your shopping at Sainsbury's and the rest at Tesco. You can do 2 weeks in the Med each year. You can be buying a two-year-old Nissan Qashqai. For the middle one, you're buying a three-year-old Ford Focus. You've got 10 nights in the Mediterranean and 3 nights in a York B&B.
It's the haircuts that do it for me.
Yeah, it is the haircuts. So for the comfortable, you've got £75 colour and cut every 6 weeks. I mean, it's stuff like that.
Big deal.
43-inch Sony Smart TV. For the moderate, you've got the, as I said before, but you're doing all your shopping at Tesco, but you don't have to be only buying own brand. For the minimum, you've got £38 per week at Tesco, but you're buying only own brand. You don't get the Ford Focus or the Qashqai, but you do get the free bus pass. And you get a 1 week UK coach holiday and 3 nights in a York B&B. If you look through this detail, okay, you can actually... Oh, you can see. People can find it very easy to picture, oh, which one of those would I be happy with? Which one could I hope for? And the drinks one is brilliant. I mean, on the minimum, you get a £4 Tesco bottle of French Merlot or 3 cans of Carling. On the moderate one, you're getting a £6 bottle of Rioja and 3 cans of Brooklyn Lager. And on the comfortable one, you're, as I said before, you're getting your £8 bottle of Sauvignon Blanc. It's absolutely brilliant, and funnily enough, actually, if you read the full report, when they talk about the drink element, they actually deliberately, this is per week, by the way, that you're allowed to have these. They did allude to the fact that they thought people might actually spend more than that per week on the alcohol, but this was in order to fit within the government's alcohol guidelines, because they didn't want to be encouraging people to drink more. And the 10, 20, 30 thing is easy to understand as well. That's obviously for an individual. If you're a couple, then it shows also, it highlights how life is cheaper for a couple. But the problem is getting to this point is quite hard, and it's got harder because if you want to secure retirement income, then you need to buy an annuity. Annuity rates are really terrible. You could keep your money invested, but then you're at the mercy of the stock market. But you know, it's not impossible. If you invested £200 a month on average over 45 years with a 5% return, you'd get a £405,000 pension pot at the end. That's not that bad. That's relatively achievable. £200 a month might be pretty tough when you're starting out, but you've got to remember that's averaged over a lifetime, and hopefully by the end of it, you'll be earning more. So as Lee said, the key to all of this is to start early. The earlier you start, the better chance you have of being able to buy an £8 bottle of New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc in your retirement.
I always find it a bit sparky, New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc, myself. I prefer something a little bit smooth. Anyway,
it didn't specify that you could only buy Zealand Sauvignon Blanc. You can buy any £8 bottle of wine.
Right.
In fact, actually, if you can find some
Rioja,
decent,
right. I prefer find some, red. I think if I'm brutally honest.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I saw a great stat this week that only 0.8% of all bottles of wine on sale in Britain are priced at more than £10.
0.8%?
Only 0.8%.
Wow.
That few?
Yeah.
Wow.
Fact.
Well, and that is actually...
we've
talked about this on the show before, actually, to just sort of veer off course, is that there is this recommendation of the amount of... With a bottle of wine, a large amount of the price that you're paying is the duty and the cost of getting the bottle of the wine into the shop. So if you pay £10 rather than £8, you're getting a considerably better wine if you go up to about 13. But once you start going above that, the effect starts to die off. So the golden spot I seem to remember from this story that was probably put out by the wine trade is just do your own research, always question what you're told, look at things when they're going up as well as they're going down. The landing zone, as Boris would say, is between about £8 and £13 to see the real uplift in quality.
Right. I don't think that many people
So
care,
stick a little bit more money in your pension now and you'll get much better wine if you spend 50p more.
There you go. Good advice, Simon. Thank you very much. We're going to stick with money, but coins. Because before George, the coin boy Nixon, was an apple in This Is Money team's eye, we had Lee, the coin man voice, the original. So for old time's sake, Lee... If anyone doesn't know what we're talking about, apologies. Basically, Lee wrote a lot of stories and won a lot of awards for doing coin stories and then handed over the mantle because basically he was taking on too much. He became the scam man, the assistant editor, blah, blah. So Lee is no longer the coin man. But we're going to the trip to the other side of the pond for this next story. It's a reader query about rare coins, but... rare American coins. So their question is, on a recent trip to the US, I noticed that some of the quarters were different designs to the usual one that you see with the eagle. So I pocketed them. I've arrived back in Britain with 7 of them. Face value $1.75. They feature 3 quarters from 1999, 1 from Pennsylvania, 1 from Connecticut, and 1 from Delaware. I also have a 2001 from South Carolina, 2015 one from Delaware, with a different design, a 2016 West Virginia quarter, and one from New Jersey from 2017 depicting Ellis Island. Can some quarter designs be rare and worth money? And could I make a mint by listing them for sale online? Lee, just to be clear, are these yours coins? Did you write this story?
No, it was a reader called B. Lewis that got in touch.
B. Lewis.
It may or may not have been my quarters, Georgie. Who knows? Can I just start by saying I was on the tube this morning and I was watching a lady going through her purse and she had a load of 50p coins and she was digging out the ones that looked quite unusual. And I thought, we're going to be talking about coins on the show today.
Did you go, I'm responsible for that.
I did. I actually, I stood there. I thought,
do you know who I am?
I'm responsible for 30 seconds of your life that you've just lost on the tube by looking through your 50p coins that you've amassed.
Better than that than Buffett.
But what that does highlight is how much people care about these types of stories. So, yes, the normal quarter, and there's billions upon billions of them, feature an eagle. You'd be quite... If you've been to the States, you'll know what I'm talking about. You see it. There is commas, Mark. What it transpires is that there are quarters that have come out in a similar vein to the Royal Mint here when they issue special coins for certain events, etc., etc. Here, it's for they launched it for different states. So each state had five different coin designs that were launched. Now the problem is none of these are particularly rare. The ones that are mentioned in this story, nor any of them, because of America being such a huge country, some of the mintage figures of them are a billion. You know, mm-hmm. and you think in this country for a coin to be rare, you know, we usually talk under a million. So, yeah. you know, it's absolutely huge amounts of these quarters are made. I would say that people in America tend to use cash more than they do in Europe. Although saying that, my recent trip to the States, for the first time, there was a big push for contactless. And I mean, bearing in mind, chip and pin was... They were quite far behind in that mm-hmm. kind of thing. There was definitely a bigger movement towards it than I'd seen on my last trip a few years ago. But people still love to pay cash, and that's why there's so many coins. So, for example, the 1999 Connecticut coin, 1.3 billion were minted. I mean, that's a huge amount. However, George did a bit of digging
All right.
to see if there are any that are rare. And there are a couple, but they need to be error coins. Now, we love an error coin where there's a minting yeah. mistake, where something's happened to the coin and it shouldn't be there or has been missed out. So there's a Wisconsin coin, which is the dairy land of America. It's very famous for, you know, cows and its produce. And basically, there is a coin from 2004 that features a cow and a bit of corn. And on the corn, there was an error on some of the coins where an extra leaf was printed. Now you think, oh, extra leaf, what's, you know, and you'd have to really sort of have a second glance at it to notice it. But if you do, you could cash in, and they sell quite frequently for more than £100 online. So if you're going to the States, keep an eye out for what quarters you get in your change.
So the question is, are they still just worth $1.75?
Well, they're worth 25 cents, Georgie, the coins, because it's quarter dollar coins, but there's seven of them, seven yeah. times, yeah. But
exactly.
Some of
altogether, I'm talking about. Like,
yeah, some of them could sell for you know, a little bit extra, but we're talking like no more than a sort of pound. And I think what that is there are people in America that also like to collect coins like they do in this country, and people will probably, there's probably people out there that want to collect the whole set, and actually there's a lot of them. So that 50 state one that I said there, each state had five different designs. You know, that's 250 coins. So people will pay to get a complete collection of coins. And of course, there's going to be a congregation of some quarters in certain states where they're issued. So you can, but you're not going to be retiring it like Woodford anytime soon. But...
All right. Good to know, Lee. It's also good to know that whoever that voice is that came back can get George to do his digging. Love it, Lee. Love it. OK, we've got another reader question, though, which I'm going to pass over to Simon, if that's all right. Simon's got head in hands here.
I've just got this wonderful vision of Lee swanning back into the office and chucking,
coins.
You know, chucking George. Seven quarters at George and saying, George, what are these worth? And George sits there, counts them up and goes, $1.50.
Do you know what's sadder is me being in America and sort of getting some change and seeing a quarter that I hadn't seen before. I thought, story.
You were that person on the tube, weren't you? Yeah. Let's
oh,
be
it's pathetic, George,
Let's
isn't it?
Be
oh,
honest.
My word. Be Lois.
All right. Okay. So we're going to move on. Another reader question. This time, cars. In January, my husband and I, not mine, reader, received our brand new car. When sorting cover for it via a comparison website, we inputted our annual mileage to be 8,000. This was based on previous years driving our old vehicle and the fact that typical usage is around 8,000 for the average driver in Britain. However, we're now 10 months into our policy and we've ticked over that mile mark. It's likely we'll do around 10,000 by the time we come to renew, and thus we have undercooked our usage, albeit not on purpose, by 2,000 miles. Should we contact our insurer Diamond to confess? All sounds very dramatic. Will it want to up our premium? And most importantly, will we invalidate our cover by getting it wrong?
So when you do your car insurance, yeah. you have to say how many miles a year you'll do. Most people do about 10 to 12,000 a year on average. Now, the more miles you do, the more likely you will be judged to have an accident.
Mm-hmm.
You're on the road for longer. Doesn't make a huge difference unless you're doing really big miles or really small miles. obviously. And for a mainstream car and a mainstream insurance policy, it's not of that much import. However, obviously, car insurers compete very, very hard to offer the best price on car on comparison sites. And one of the ways that they do this is by having more importance nowadays on the mileage than perhaps they used to. And so it could be that you say, I'm going to do 8,000 miles, and actually you do 10,000 miles. You're doing 25% more driving than you said you were going to do there. And an insurer might decide, well, that's not on. We're going to try and wriggle out of your claim. Or they might decide that you deliberately dropped the mileage down to 8,000 in order to save yourselves 50 quid or 100 quid on your insurance. And so you deliberately lied. Especially if they go back through your motoring history and see that you've done 10,000 miles a year every year for the last 10 years. Because most people will tend to do pretty much exactly the same every year. It's funny how it works out like that. So if you do this and you do suddenly realise that you're going to go over, then you should contact your insurer. Now, probably in most cases, they might say to you, look, you're going to do an extra 1,000 miles. It really doesn't matter. If they're a bit mean, they might say to you, well, we're going to have to up the mileage on your policy, and that means that you're going to have to pay us some extra money. And if they're really, really mean, they'll charge you some money for the privilege of paying them extra money. They might charge you a £25 admin fee for the privilege of paying them £25. Mm-hmm. As I said, on a mainstream car insurance policy, this doesn't matter so much. Where it really does matter is on things like classic car insurance policies, which are limited mileage policies, and those are substantially cheaper because you've said you're going to do less miles. So, for example, on my car, I've got a 3,000 mile a year limit. And if I was to bust that substantially to go up to 4,000 or 5,000, I would really need to be telling the insurer. Because whilst they probably couldn't completely wriggle out of paying a claim for your car being stolen or written off, they might try to wriggle out some of it, and you really don't want to give them any excuse to do so.
It's got me thinking, because I'm thinking, what did I put into mine?
So the easiest way to... So most of them will default when you do the comparison. They'll default to about 10,000, and then you can change the number. So unless you change the number, you'll probably be fairly accurate. But there's an easy way of checking this now. There's a brilliant service online, the MOT check service online. Mm-hmm. And you can, with the number plate and the make of the car, you can go and check the MOT history of any car. It's really useful if you're buying a car, go check the MOT history. It's really useful if you're just nosy and geeky. Some of us might be. but you could look up your car and you can see how many miles you did each year. So you don't even need your current car. For example, if you've bought a new car, you can look up your old car's number plate, or you can look up the one before's number plate. In fact, if you want to know whether the first car you ever owned is still on the road, you can look that car up and find that out too.
So look, is the best advice, look, be honest.
Yeah, be honest and pay attention.
In that note, I'm Googling car insurance. No, on my Gmail account. I don't even know who my car insurer is. Oh, my God, Simon. And you said you can remember back to February. I only got it about 3 months ago.
Also, I mean, there is something else going on here, which is it's probably highly unlikely that your car insurer will actually check up on your mileage unless you have got some outlandishly low figure. But they might do. It's got easier and easier and easier for them to find out the mileage. Once upon a time, it would have been quite difficult for them to actually check up on it, and apart from sending someone round to read the odometer. But nowadays, they can just do it online by checking up on, you know, it'll be entered in digitally from the garage. They can get the records digitally from the garage. They can check the MOT history and see how many miles it did last time it was MOT'd. So it's easier for them to check up on you.
Fabulous. And the good news is, I now know who my car insurer is. Thank you very much, Simon. You can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you would like to get in contact with us, any really questions that you have,
email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk, tweet us at thisismoney, or come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find all of the articles past the podcast is published in, and debate the issues in the reader comments. And if you too have been to a foreign country and have a coin that you think might be rare, don't contact me.
No. It's George Nixon, by the way. You can contact Lee, but he'll just pass it over to George. It's fine. Lee, good to have you back as well from paternity leave. How
thank
was
you
that?
Very much. It was really good, Georgie. Thank you. Yeah, it was challenging but rewarding. Let's leave it there. But yeah, it was good. I'm really glad I did it, and yeah, kind of missing baby now. I'm 1 week back, and but good to be back in the office and be back in the studio as well.
It's lovely to have you back, Lee. If you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.